Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the movie review podcast where we review movies on this podcast of ours. My name is William Bibbiani. I'm a film critic. I write for The Wrap, and everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a film critic. I am senior staff writer over at Slash Film. I don't have a clever nickname. Don't need one. My name is strange enough.
Well, fair enough. And I respect that. This week on Critically Acclaimed, we've got a little bit of catching up to do. We have some movies that have come out.
From the last 2 weeks.
And we're going to be reviewing them. We're going to be reviewing the new Pixar sequel, Inside Out 2. The new horror film with Russell Crowe, The Exorcism, no relation to the Pope's Exorcist. The new Yorgos Lanthimos movie, Kinds of Kindness. The new Korean horror film, Exuma. And a new film, I think this is this an HBO original?
That's an HBO documentary about a hit Broadway show.
It's called Slave Play, not a movie, a play. Yes. We like to start with the biggest release, and boy, is it a big release. It is a staggeringly successful film at the box office.
As we're recording this, it's in its second week of release, and it's already the highest grossing film of the year domestically.
Yeah.
It beating out, I think, Dune Part 2.
It was Dune Part 2, yeah.
But it's Inside Out Part 2.
Yeah. It's a film. Inside Out is a Pixar film that came out about 10 years ago now, give or take.
It was like 2011? It was a while back.
It was a while back. And, I think it is... There have been good Pixar films since. I think there's arguably been two or three great Pixar films since. Mm. This one feels like the last Pixar film of, like, the old wave, where almost every Pixar movie was like, hey, you know the real world? Well, there's, like, a tiny part of it, and now it's personified. Like, here's what your toys are doing when you're not around.
Yeah.
Here's what bugs are doing when we're not looking at them. Here's what the monster in your closet is doing, that kind of thing.
The joke that was being told at the time was Pixar's ethos for a while was, what if blank had feelings?
Basically.
What if toys had feelings? What if your closet monster had feelings? And Inside Out was the ultimate Pixar film, because what if feelings had feelings?
You know what? That's not wrong.
Yeah, it has the same premise as the sitcom Herman's Head, where...
Because everyone... Everyone from our generation knows that reference, even though it was not a popular show. I think it didn't last very long.
It didn't last very long, but it stuck in the consciousness the same way Manimal did. You know, nobody saw it, but everybody kind of understands it.
I watched every episode of Herman's Head. Herman's Head was a sitcom that was on in the 90s that was...
Let me look up Herman's Head.
But Herman's Head was basically Inside Out, except it was about like an office worker in a sitcom. And every time...
91.
It was about an office worker in a very sitcom kind of environment. But every time something dramatic happened, we would cut to inside his head, and different aspects of his personality would be sort of duking it out over what to do at any given moment. It's a good idea. Pixar did it better. Excuse me. The original Inside Out...
And it wasn't the same character. There was, I think, characters were compassion, intelligence. One of them was lust. That was like
it was a very early 90s horny sitcom kind of vibe. Inside Out is an interesting film
it was sensitivity, lust, anxiety, and intellect. Those were the four emotions we got on Herman's Head.
Fair enough.
There's also jealousy, who is Bob Goldthwait.
Well, that
Bobcat Goldthwait showed up as jealousy in one episode. Leslie Nielsen was gone.
Just God inside his head.
Yes.
Is that faith, or is that actually just God lives inside Herman's head?
I think that's the way God was communicating with Herman, was as an emotion.
Okay, well, I don't remember that episode, and that makes it very complex. But in any case, one thing I really like about Inside Out, the original, aside from the concept is actually pretty strong, is that the concept is already big enough that they didn't need to oversell it. Mm. It's a story about a little girl who moves, like her family moves to San Francisco.
Yeah, she's from like the Midwest. Suburban Midwest.
Yeah.
And then she moves into, like, the city of San Francisco, and she hates it.
Yeah, she has
she's 11 years old, she changes schools.
Her friends aren't there. It's and so many family movies begin with, oh, I hate moving.
Yeah.
Because, well, you
it's
know...
it's hard. It's hard for a kid.
You know, I never really moved as a kid, and I don't mean to belittle that experience, but it's done to death in movies. Almost every family movie seems to begin with, all right, kids, here's our new home. Don't get into any adventures. Like... it's been done. But there's no... Riley doesn't get into any adventures. She's just trying to process that she feels really sad.
Mm.
And she's never really dealt with a really being depressed before. Yeah, she doesn't know how to process it. And she can't really tell her parents about it because her own emotions aren't figuring it out. And her sense of joy tries to overwhelm her sense of sadness... because being happy is better than being sad, and what joy ultimately learns is that sadness is important.
Sadness is important. A whole range of emotions, blending emotions together, is an important part of forming memories. There's some mechanics within the film. We have the five core emotions. There's joy, sadness, fear, disgust, and anger.
Yeah.
And these are all little personified, sort of Muppety-looking things that live inside of her head.
They're actually, like, it looks like they're made of phloam. If you, like, zoom in real close, like there's little bits of them pointillism. Floating.
And they are in control of her. And there's, like, this big control panel where they kind of manipulate her decisions in this sort of symbiotic way. I remember you took exception to the original and that there was no intellect
figure. Logic. In this. I interviewed Pete Docter, who directed the original, and I asked him about that. It says it feels like there would be a part of the human brain that is trying to just simply suss things out.
Yeah.
And he actually said that in an early draft, there was a character called Logic.
Mm.
And when everything started going haywire in the script, all of the emotions literally threw Logic out the window.
Right.
Which is funny. I admit that that's funny.
It's a cute visual gag.
It got in the way. I get it, but there's the problem with a lot of these Pixar movies that sort of explain how the universe works is once you start really getting into it, they don't make a lot of sense. Like Soul, the mechanics of Soul do not make sense.
Soul is not a good picture.
I'm not a fan.
Something that always bothered me about Ratatouille was the marionette aspect.
Yeah.
That the rat can sit on his head, pull on his hair, and somehow control his arms. Like, well, I'm willing to suspend my disbelief that there's an intelligent cooking rat.
Yeah.
But I know that when you pull on my hair, I'm not a marionette.
They try to hand wave that by saying that, like, over, like, one really long night, they, like, worked out a system. It's not that he's controlling him, it's that he's giving him, like, cues.
He's literally controlling him. He pulls on his hair and can't control his arms.
I realize that. The idea, I think, was that he pull on his hair at, like, this one part, and he knows that means to move his right arm. But...
oh, okay.
It ends up becoming... They just needed an excuse. They just couldn't think of a way to make it work, and they just said, fuck it, we don't care.
For some
the audience
reason,
won't care. Let's move on.
For some reason, the intelligent cooking rat is okay, but that part bothered me. Inside Out, I didn't really mind. I thought it was kind of a fascinating way of like visualizing emotions and the way we kind of live by certain emotions. I also thought it was incredibly mature for a kids' film to explain to little kids who are constantly, especially American kids, who are fed on a media diet of utter unending happiness. You must be exhilarated and joyful at all times.
Yeah, everything's cool.
Everything is cool and fun. You are in charge.
Mm-hmm.
To have a film that says, you're going to grow up. Joy is not going to rule your life. In fact... And it's not going to be as clear-cut as sometimes I'm happy and sometimes I'm sad. In fact, the climax of that movie, the one that made me cry, was the creation of Bittersweet.
Yeah.
That sad and happy can exist in the same memory.
Yeah.
And that's kind of... And the memories emerge inside the young girl's brain. The character's named Riley. As these little spheres, these, like, crystal balls. And those crystal balls are sort of filed away as memories, or they're given to sort of a dump where they're forgotten.
Yeah.
There's islands that appear inside of her head that are sort of like...
her values, her family, the things that she cares about
the most deeply. This new film, Inside Out 2, has... a new conceit.
Yeah.
Because she's 13 now.
Yeah.
And she's starting to form beliefs.
Yeah. Yeah. A core sense of self is forming. Yeah.
And it's visualized by Joy picks up some memories and feeds them into this pool inside of Riley's brain. And they grow in these like sort of strands that she can pluck.
Yeah. It's almost like they're growing like a tree out of seeds. But like the top of the tree is like some kind of this abstract sort of object or idol.
This little abstract knot. Yeah. And that's the thing that core belief about herself, her sense of identity, forms in this little tree. I think that's kind of an interesting new development.
I think it's once again, it's exploring something that the original movie didn't. Here's the thing. There are, when you create a story like Inside Out and you're saying, here's what the inside of everyone's head is like. Mm. It's very difficult to introduce new things, at least from a sort of a storytelling structural conceit,
uh-huh.
because where was it before? Yeah. We saw inside the heads of adults.
Yes.
In the previous films. And I'm going to talk about something about that in a minute as it relates to something separate from what we're talking about now. But we saw inside the heads of adults. I didn't see their core beliefs. Now, that's not terribly important. We can just say it was off to the side somewhere. This one kind of makes sense. But in addition to developing the sort of core sense of self, which they're trying to sort of preserve and make sure that Riley has a sort of healthy sense of self and healthy values, in the middle of the night, there's an alarm going off on the control panel, and all of the emotions sort of slink out of bed, and like, what the hell's going on? And they press this glowing button, and that activates puberty.
Oh, no, it just activates on its own.
No, they have to press it.
No, they actually have to, they freak out, and they pull off the button, and they try to throw it away.
Oh, but, yeah, yeah, sorry. Yeah, there's a moment where
that alerts, like, a construction crew that's like smash into Riley's brain and it's like leave her emotions a mess. Isn't that a cute little metaphor?
They update the control panel. So now every time an emotion presses like, sadness is going to like try to activate a button, but now she's 100% sad all the time.
Yeah.
And she's 100% disgusted all the time. Mm. It's like, it's all mood swings. And that's funny.
That's funny.
I can appreciate that.
And most notably, there are new guys.
There are new emotions.
New emotions move into the control room.
Yeah, because you remember when you hit puberty and all of a sudden you had new emotions?
Kinda.
Really?
It feels that way.
You didn't have okay, because here's the emotions that get added when you hit puberty.
Anxiety is kind of like the big one. The new ruler of this new group and tries to supplant Joy. The leader of Riley's emotions.
Not a villain, but certainly the antagonist of the film. You have ennui, which is basically sort of boredom and thinking sarcasm. You're kind of above it all. Yeah. There's embarrassment, who's this really big, shy one. And then there's envy.
Hmm.
Now, I don't know about you, but before I hit puberty, I had a ton of anxiety. Before I hit puberty, I was absolutely capable of envy. Before I hit puberty, I was embarrassed all the time.
Hmm.
And ennui is, I admit, slightly complicated, but I'm pretty sure I had that too. And I get it.
Hmm.
We have to come up with an excuse for why there's suddenly new emotions, and puberty is as good an excuse as any.
Yeah.
It's a little forced. I'm not complaining. You're stuck with it. I think they did the best job they could. It's a little forced.
I'm okay with this conceit because those types of feelings tend to magnify when you're an adolescent. Something that they kind of ignore. Unlike Turning Red, she doesn't have to deal with getting tampons or menstruation or hormonal changes in her body.
No, that part
is completely ignored.
Yeah.
Also, where's her libido? She's 13,
doesn't really have one.
She has like a crush on boys. There was Boy Band Island in the last film.
He also seems to have a crush on a girl in this one. There's a new character.
She's very enamored of a new best friend. That's kind of the conceit of the movie.
The exterior sort of plot, the thing that's happening to Riley is she's just about to leave middle school and go to high school, and she just found out that her best friends will be going to a different high school, and they're going to a weekend hockey camp with the hockey team of the new school Riley's going to go to, and she's torn between wanting to spend one last halcyon weekend with her friends and wanting to build new friends, new foundation for her future.
And this wanting to build a new foundation for her future is inspired entirely by anxiety.
Yeah.
This new little orange creature with a tuft of hair. And the way this film talks about anxiety and the way it kind of defines anxiety in a way a little kid might understand, I think is really intelligent.
I agree.
I love the way they write the character of anxiety. And in fact, there's a sequence where anxiety is sort of leaked into Riley's imagination. That's another realm that they get to visit.
Anxiety is now sort of taking control of it and is telling all the workers in her imagination center what to imagine.
And yeah, here's what you need to imagine. And what anxiety is, and this is kind of what anxiety is, it's your imagination sketching out every possible worst case scenario and convincing you that you need to prepare for all of them.
Yep. I have been diagnosed with general anxiety disorder. Mm-hmm. I'm on medication for general anxiety disorder. That's the thing about this movie is I think this is actually a pretty good way to describe anxiety. But here's the thing. Anxiety, when it's overwhelming, feels like it's just trying to attack you. Like I sometimes feel like my anxiety is trying to kill me.
Well, and there is an anxiety attack.
There is.
In this movie.
There is. Yeah. But when I'm in the middle of it, it just feels... I feel like I'm in danger. Mm. There's no positivity to it. And what Inside Out 2 argues, without undermining or making it seem less harsh than it is, what it's pointing out is that anxiety is trying to help you.
Yeah.
It just doesn't know how. Anxiety is, initially, when we see anxiety sort of first take control of the control panel, it's just, hey, listen, we actually should be mindful of the future. Mm. And make choices that will benefit us in the future. And Joy is like, okay, that's actually a good idea. But then when
fear, of course, loves anxiety.
Yeah, it feels like anxiety is the best. But fear, they say fear represents fear of what's actually here and now. Whereas anxiety is fear of what might happen. Anxiety is trying to protect you by making you prepare for the worst. But when anxiety is going out of control, you're losing all sense of perspective, and you're living in that imaginary future, and you're making bad decisions as a result, or at least that's the risk.
And that's what they dramatize in the movie.
Yeah,
begins behaving very poorly to her friends, and makes bad decisions in little social ways, like in the first one.
Yeah,
there's not like a world ending problem. The world ending problem is the emotional state of a young girl.
Yeah,
and I like that. That's the stakes. And they try to make action sequences out of it. I appreciate that when Ennui takes control of the board, the emotions board. It's like, how do you defend yourself when you really like something that's kind of embarrassing? Oh, and like, Ennui cracks her knuckles, like, oh, I know how to handle... And of course, she's French. I know how to handle this one.
Yeah, she's played by Adele Exarchopoulos, isn't she?
Yes.
Yeah, great casting.
And she builds in Riley's mind a sarcasm.
Yeah, that's a great joke.
it's a
huge ravine, and the emotions happen to be on one side when it forms, and they see some other workers on the other side, and they're trying to talk to them, and it's like, oh, hey, I'm so glad we ran into you guys! But on the other side of the sarcasm,
sarcasm.
Oh, hey, I'm so glad we ran into you guys!
It's reminded of that Kids in the Hall bit.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I'm not being sarcastic. I have a speech impediment.
Yeah, but, no, but it's a good gag in Inside Out, and they do have some really excellent, visualizations of what's going on inside the mind. Nothing quite, I think, as inspired as the last one. It feels like most of the big stuff in the last one.
Yeah, and they're kind of just extending it. I mean, it still got me. I was still weeping like a child at the end.
I think it's quite good. I think it's a good film. I think it's kind of repeating a similar formula as the last one, but it is doing so in a different... for a different narrative reason, but also in an attempt to dramatize in an entertaining way a complex subject. It's a little oversimplified, but it's a complex subject so that kids can understand it, and I think that's good work. It's actually fun, entertaining, emotional, and it has a lesson that's a little bit more complicated than be yourself.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and you're going to have all of these emotions.
Yeah.
And anxiety is going to be a part of your life. And in fact, one of the big revelations Joy comes to is that Joy might be less important to Riley growing up. And in fact, when we see inside the adults' heads, we didn't see anxiety in their heads in the last movie.
No.
But anxiety does pop up in one of their heads at one point, and one of the characters says, oh, you're back. I remember you. That's something we all kind of experienced, but they kind of
They hand-waved away the fact that they the way the movie ends with what they decide anxiety, it's like sort of function in the mind is.
Yeah.
sort of helps him get away with that.
And you know what? I actually really like the way they dealt with it.
I think they did it good. I think it's pretty healthy. It's a little oversimplified, but I think it's pretty healthy.
You'll note that in Riley's head, the leader of the emotions, the main character of the movie, is Joy, is played by Amy Poehler. However, when you go over into the adults' heads, they're ruled by other emotions. Yeah. You'll notice that in the father's head, anger is the one in the center seat. And you go into the mom's head, and sadness is the one in the center seat.
Which tells you quite a bit about their marriage.
About adulthood, perhaps.
Raises questions. Yeah, there's a thing... Here's the thing that I was actually like, is I have... I hesitate to call it headcanon, because I actually think it's supported by the text. It's just not said out loud, because Disney isn't good about saying these kinds of things out loud. But one of the interesting observations, I think, that has been made about the original Inside Out, is that inside Riley's head, all of the emotions represent multiple genders. Whereas inside the head of Riley's mother, they're all female. Whereas inside the head of Riley's father, they're all male. And all the other characters whose insides of the heads that we see in these movies, even in Inside Out 2, I was worried that they might like change that up or try to like sort of retcon that. I guess not worry, but I thought maybe they would. It's always uniform. Riley is a name that is non-gender specific. Riley seems to have this attraction to multiple different people. I think Riley is queer and probably gender queer, and we just haven't engaged with that because it's Disney, but I do think it's all in there. And I'm glad that even though this movie probably couldn't address it, even if it's intentional, I'm glad that they didn't try to disprove that. They didn't try to go back on it.
That's fair.
I like that they left that in, whether that was by intent or whatever. I mean, I'm glad that that's still available.
I suppose so. Everything in the text indicates that she's heteronormative.
Well, you can also
She has crushes on boys. She has an embarrassing crush that she doesn't want to talk to on a boy.
She also has the way that she treats the leader of the girls' hockey team is they treat that as like a meet cute. Like, that is very much so. And listen, you can be genderqueer and still into boys.
It could be read as a crush on this girl, but it could just as easily be read as a friendship with this girl and wanting to impress a cool new friend.
I guess the whole point of this is kind of universality.
Yeah.
And it doesn't feel like, even though they can't come out and say anything, it doesn't feel like anyone's being left out. In fact, they leave... She wears a rainbow shirt the entire fucking movie.
It's fair. But it also is that kind of passive progressive that Disney is so notorious for. We're going to have a queer character, but we're not going to say anything about it. They're going to be queer in a single line of dialogue, so we can edit that out for a Chinese audience.
Yeah, or other audiences around the world. But
I'm not quite willing to give them the benefit of the doubt on this.
It pisses me off that so many studios, and Disney is a prime offender of this, aren't willing to come out and say characters are queer. Even if they're, like, allowing it to be implied. But I would argue that in this case, at the very least, they didn't deny it.
That's true.
And they could have. Yeah. They could have made a very clear, like, oh, Riley's super into boys or super femme or whatever as she's getting older. Or they're getting older, I don't know. But, like, I'm glad that they left it in.
Okay.
I guess is my point. It's better than not... Yeah. Better than taking it away. But no, I think this is a really good movie. I don't think it hits the emotional heights of the original Inside Out. I think this is a bit more, because it's about more complicated emotions, it doesn't have those, like, it doesn't have the Bing Bong moment. Where it's just, like, this devastating, destroy your childhood moment of, like, cinematic tragedy. Well,
I admit I felt incredibly wistful every time they visited that sort of core tree, like, the core belief about herself.
Yeah.
And they stroked it, and all we heard was, like, Riley's voice saying, I'm a good person.
Yeah.
That made me choke up a little bit. Right? Every single damn time they touched that thing.
It's sweet. It's sweet. No, I think it's good, but I think, you know, some people think that, like, if a movie sequel isn't better than the original, then it hasn't done its job. I think a movie sequel just needs to justify its existence.
This one introduced some new interesting concepts. It didn't overplay it. It wasn't over busy, I think, because we already knew the core five emotions. It does kind of rush through a lot of the explanations, but that's because it had the first movie to do that for it.
Yeah.
But that's not a major failing. The only thing that really concerns me about this movie was it was very successful, and its success came on the heels of a really disheartening press release from Pixar Studios where because they had such financial failures with a couple of their more recent movies.
Yeah, and to be fair, COVID hit them hard, and Disney decided to release Pixar movies straight to Disney Plus a lot of the time. So
Turning Red is one of the biggest bombs of all time. Mm-hmm. I think it's like the 11th biggest bomb of all time in terms of money lost. Luca wasn't a big hit because that was also straight to streaming. And Onward, Soul didn't do very well.
And Onward came out like the first week of lockdown or the right before when people were starting to be really cautious. So it underperformed too.
And because those were all original films, the message is that the executives took was, well, clearly people want Toy Story 5. Mm-hmm. They want the same characters again.
Well, I would argue that Lightyear didn't do that great.
That's true. Lightyear was a bomb as well.
Yeah. And I would argue that
that's also not a very good movie.
And I would argue that Elemental, which is actually a good movie, I finally caught up with it, and it's not amazing, but it's well made. The animation's beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
Elemental was initially written off as a box office dud because it had a bad opening weekend, which is what everyone judges every movie on now. But Elemental, and not enough movies get to do this nowadays, Elemental stuck around.
Yeah.
Elemental just kept doing well, and so they left it in theaters long enough that it eventually became, not their biggest hit, but a hit.
Like a legit hit. And I think a big issue, though, is merch. It really was just merch.
Merch's probably a lot of it. Because
the Cars movies were successful, mm-hmm. but whatever they made at the box office, they quintupled in ice cream cakes mm-hmm. and birthday party supplies. It was a way to sell toys and actually become a bit of a marketing bonanza. You could do that with Toy Story as well.
Yeah. It's harder to market Soul as
nobody,
a toy.
Nobody wants a Soul toy. Nobody wants the dad's legs from Onward.
I just want to see that walking around Disneyland. Just the legs? How would we even do
that? Remember they gave it like this like weird stuffed dead torso
it would work. I know, I think about it. Yeah, but it's still weird though.
But if you're like one of those character actors walking around Disneyland, and you can't do anything with your face or arms. You can only, like, dance around with your legs.
No, that's a rough gig. But no, you're right. A lot of those movies, and I think they're exceptions. I think as much as I thought Lightyear sucked, I Sox the Cat is very toyetic.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you definitely want to buy that. Someone, I think it was Pitch Meeting, made the point that, like, why would Andy watch the movie Lightyear and want a Buzz toy and not a Sox toy? The movie makes no convincing argument for that. Surely you'd want Sox. That would be the best-selling toy.
I got to talk to the makers of Lightyear, and I asked, you know, was there ever a point in the script where it was, like, more of a 90s movie?
Yeah.
They said no. We just did it the way we were going to do it.
That movie is a huge... I just think conceptually that movie was just a weird play. Like, I get the concept. The way they executed it makes no sense in my head at all. It doesn't really... I don't really see a kid being that enamored of that film, but we're off in the weeds. But you're right. No, it's the toyetic quality. But the thing is that a lot of those movies that underperformed for reasons mostly outside of their control, they were the personal ones. They were the ones that were about, like, really, you know, people's human experiences. Turning Red is apparently, like, you know, very personal to the filmmaker. Yeah. Luca feels very intimate and, you know.
Well, it's also very specific. It's about, you know, a small Italian seaside village.
Sure.
You know, Soul was about a jazz musician in New York.
I mean, Ratatouille is about French chefs. Like, you know, that's kind of specific, too.
Whereas their bigger hits, Cars, Toy Story, are much broader in that kind of American sitcom way. It's just every town America.
And listen, you could say that our focus needs to be less intimate and more the classical Pixar, let's take an abstraction and humanize it. Like, you can maybe say we want to try doing that again, but it does feel like, because Inside Out 2 was like one of the bigger hits of the year and there haven't been a lot, they're just going to make sequels now, aren't they?
And that's what they said. They were going, and that press release that I was alluding to, that Pixar is only going to make sequels. They're not going to be creative moving forward. They're just going to lean on the characters you already know. And, you know, my Gen X heart split in half. It's like, no. A lot of the movies you were making are actually quite good. Be daring, you know, make the big swings. I understand you have to make money, but I want interesting art before you make money. So do that.
A lot of people think that it is, like a film studio's job to make money. It's not. It's to make movies that make money. Mm. And in order to make movies that make money, you have to make good movies. Now, granted, sometimes those are sequels. Inside Out 2 is very good. Well, and it can be done.
That's why I feel a little bit of a wince when I give it a good review, because I really like the movie, but it's playing into... an intended trend by the studio to be less creative. And I can only hope that they can find some creativity in this ultra-commercial path they've decided to walk.
And I think Pixar has... They don't always do that, but I think they have done that in the past. So fingers crossed this won't be, you know, a fallow time. Mm. But, I mean, that's the thing, though. Like, you and I, like, I think most people have principles, things that they care about. And when it comes to art, though, we have to deal with... We have to look at the movie that we got, even if it is made under an auspice that we disapprove of. And if the movie is good, we have to say it's good. I mean, we can't say, like, it's bad because we disapprove with their ethos. This happens to be a good movie, and we have to reckon with that. But we also need to have the larger conversation beyond that, which is that doubling down on just IP, just rehash the IP for money, isn't really a great prospect. It is. I don't think it's great for the industry. I don't think it's great for the art, because people are, we're going to get tired of it eventually. And then you won't have anything else to fall back on. You won't have anything else to exploit, because you have to make new things in order to do that. Mm-hmm. And I think it's bad for kids.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the thing with a lot of these, the Pixar movies age a little better than a lot of other family movies, because they tend to take place in this sort of alternate universe that kind of never ages. But you still don't want to, like, grow up on your grandparents' stuff.
Yeah.
And well, we're not quite there with Pixar, but still, Inside Out came out a long time ago. And I think the little kids are probably of the right age to watch Inside Out 1 and not Inside Out 2 yet. And so we're just going to run into some weirdness. Anytime you decide to just go down one path in an entertainment industry, you run the risk of running out of road.
Yeah.
And I think that's what concerns me more than anything else. Like, I'm fine with making sequels, but exclusively? Come on. Anyway, we need to move on. There's one other movie that we both saw this week. And it is an interesting film. It is called The Exorcism. It was co-written and also directed by Joshua John Miller. Joshua John Miller was a child actor in the 80s. He was the vampire kid in Catherine Bigelow's Near Dark.
Yeah,
you might remember him from the movie Teen Witch, and he is also the son of Jason Miller. Jason Miller was he won a Pulitzer Prize for theater. He's a talented actor, talented writer, and he was also nominated for an Oscar for co-starring in The Exorcist as the young priest who was having a crisis of faith.
Yeah.
So his latest movie is...
Oh, and I need to point out that he was also in a 1991 film called And You Thought Your Parents Were Weird.
Oh, yeah.
Where he's an engineer, and he builds, like, a robot with, like, a colander for a head and mechanical hands, and the spirit of his dead father possesses it. He's able to communicate with his dad again.
Yeah.
And I saw that film in theaters because his younger brother is played by a classmate of mine.
Ah, fun.
Yeah, actor named Don Gross. And of course, because he's a child actor, we're all very impressed at the elementary school.
It's like
he's like in commercials and stuff.
That's cool.
We always like to brag. He played the voice of Chucky in Child's Play prior to Possession.
Right, not like Brad Dorff. Like, we're like, I'm Chucky, wanna play? Yeah, that voice.
That voice. That was a classmate of mine.
Cool. Well, back on point.
He was a cool kid when he was 10.
Fair enough. But back on point. So Joshua John Miller, whose dad starred in The Exorcist, has made a movie about a kid whose dad is starring in a remake of The Exorcist. And he's also struggling with what seems at first to be his personal demons. He's a recovering addict. But he may actually also be actually possessed by actual demons, because you may recall the rumors, the scuttlebutt, that the production of The Exorcist itself was haunted.
Yeah, although the movie, I don't think they ever give the title of the movie that they're making.
Georgetown Project.
Well, but they explain that the Georgetown Project is a code. They don't actually give the name of the real movie.
They call
but
it. They say it's a remake, and I think.
And they say it's a remake, but they also name check The Exorcist, so it's not a remake of The Exorcist.
Kind of a remake of The Exorcist.
It looks
exactly like a remake of The Exorcist.
It's the same way.
It's inside of the house. It looks like the same house.
It's the same way Sutter Kane is Stephen King in The Mouth of Madness.
Stephen King / H.P. Lovecraft.
Even though they mention Stephen King by name, Sutter Kane is also kind of like Stephen King in that universe.
It's a stand-in.
I'm okay with that little bit of fudging and fuzzing of the lines.
I think everyone in the audience is getting the right vibe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Russell Crowe is essentially playing a kind of a combination of Russell Crowe and Mel Gibson.
Mm-hmm.
He's a shamed actor who was once very acclaimed, but who is now very much out of the public eye because of some very bad public behavior. He was an alcoholic and a cocaine addict, and he famously abandoned his daughter and his wife.
Mm-hmm. When his wife was dying of cancer. Yeah.
His daughter is now 16.
Mm-hmm.
The performer playing the daughter is 26, but we're going to ignore
that. Yeah, that's Hollywood, though. Yeah. They don't look entirely convincing. Their name is Ryan Simpkins.
Yeah.
They were in the Fear Street movies, and I thought they were really good in it.
Yeah, those Fear Street movies are really good.
Yeah.
But yeah, he is trying to reconnect with his daughter. She just got kicked out of school for vandalizing one of the teacher's cars.
Yeah.
So he's trying to say, oh, well, you know, I pulled a lot of favors, and maybe we can get you back in. And this is my big break, is I'm going to redeem myself in the public eye by appearing as a priest in this Exorcist-like film remake.
Yeah.
But he is also confronted daily by the worst director imaginable.
Yeah, it's played by Adam Goldberg. Oh my god, he is disgusting.
I love Adam Goldberg, and he plays such a horror... Because Adam Goldberg, this character's direction for his actor is to repeatedly bring up what a piece of shit he is right to his face.
And his childhood trauma, because it turns out that in addition to having all these substance abuse, and it's probably, like, one of the reasons why he turned to that as a coping mechanism, I don't want to oversimplify it, the movie makes a connection, was he was abused by the clergy when he was young, and I will not go into detail about it, the movie does to some extent. Adam Goldberg, in an attempt to manipulate him into giving the performance he wants, later in the movie, he says maybe the most fucked up sentence I've ever heard in a film.
Mm-hmm.
Just the thing he says to him about that childhood trauma is, I wanted the demon to kill him right then and there. I feel like if you say anything
horrible,
if you say anything that evil, like God should strike you down.
And here's the thing,
right there,
he's doing all of this, and he's still not getting the performance he wants. You'd think he'd change tactics a little bit.
Yeah, the movie's in trouble now, and he's just not. I don't know. He's just a real piece of shit.
And yeah, as this horrible director keeps bringing it up, and the daughter keeps bringing it up, and he's feeling more and more stress, and he's like thinking about the bottle again, and you know, that's when the movie adds a little bit of special effects, puts some like darkness around his eyes to indicate that he's becoming possessed by something.
I think that's a really cool touch, actually, because that's like, you know, it's like sunken eyes when you haven't slept or you're not treating yourself well, but they're so sunken, like his eyes are vanishing in a monstrous way. I thought that was actually a good
kind of a cool visual. And and he starts speaking in voices, and it's really weird. The first half of this movie is actually pretty good in terms of what it's communicating. I loved the pacing and the atmosphere. There's a lot of scenes of just people walking around, a lot of just ambient noise, kind of living on the set. The set is pretty cool looking, where they built a whole house inside a soundstage.
Yeah. It looks like a giant doll house.
And then they like sliced off one of the walls so you can look inside all the rooms and move the camera around. I think that's kind of a neat touch. And then once the demon stuff starts happening, it just goes to shit. It just becomes terrible. Russell Crowe is doing everything he can. Russell Crowe never stopped being an excellent actor. He is always there.
I would argue that he hasn't had a great role since The Nice Guys.
It's been a second.
And I would argue that this is actually, like, even though I think it doesn't completely fall apart in the second half, I think it was never subtle. This feels like black box theater to me. It's all very intimate and very, like, messy and in your face with its emotions. I'm fine with that. I think it's a perfectly good approach. I do think it hits the gas too hard in the second half and tries to be too much of a horror movie, and it kind of loses its balance. But I don't think it completely falls apart. But I think Russell Crowe is holding on to it.
Yeah.
I think he's really good. And the thing about Russell Crowe... Russell Crowe, like, burst onto the scene. He'd been doing work before, but it's, like, his breakout roles were these really in-your-face, angry characters, like Bud White in L.A. Confidential, or Romper Stomper, or... Mm-hmm. And it's, like, He's...
Or Sid 6.7.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Virtuosity. He's a serial killer.
He's fun in that movie. I don't know if that was a hit, but, like, he was fun in that movie. Mm-hmm. Here, he's meek. He's, like, defeated and sad, and he knows he's done wrong. And there's something about seeing an actor of that much power feel powerless that really nails it for me. And I just, there's like little bits where he's like trying to, I think he's trying to be a dad, but he knows he's kind of given that up. Like he doesn't have the right, but he wants to, and he's trying, and he feel like he just, you feel it. Like he's, it's a really, really good performance, I think. And I think it anchors the film even when it veers too hard in one direction. The
When it starts going a little bit more into Exorcist, because what happens in an Exorcist movie? Somebody's going to be tied to a bed.
There's
gonna
somebody's going to
bend over backwards. Yeah. Somebody's going to
David Hyde Pierce plays the priest.
He's like the, consulting the priest.
Yeah, which is that's a fun way to get that character in there.
David Hyde Pierce, he is given so little interesting dialogue. He gives mostly exposition. And David Hyde Pierce is actually also a very good actor.
Amazing actor, I think.
And he is trying so hard to give, like, single words of dialogue some personality.
Yeah.
And then when he gets involved in sort of the exorcism stuff at the end, it's like, what are we doing here?
Well, just, I think there is
actually
something.
All of a sudden you have these great actors who are just sort of, like, growling and bending over backwards and saying the power of Christ compels you, like in any other Exorcist knockoff that we've had since the 1970s.
I think you're not giving it quite enough credit at the end, because I think what's happening at the end of that movie, and I think what's happening throughout the movie, is that I feel like, because so much of the darkness in this movie stems from the darkness in the Catholic Church itself.
Yeah.
I feel like this movie is talking about how, you know, like when, like, say, like, oh, these movies are about the devil, are cursed. And I think this movie is saying that's because Catholicism is cursed. Like, it has, this history that it itself created.
Uh-huh.
Not from the outside, from the devil, but from the inside. And I look at that David Hyde Pierce character, and there's this scene where Ryan Simpkins and their character is dating one of the actors in the movie by that point. Mm.
Which the romance was completely tacked.
It's tacked on.
It was one of those, we need to give that character something to do. So
someone to talk to.
The character's having a romance.
It's fine. It's a little perfunctory, but it's fine. But they're worried about Russell Crowe's character, and so they go to the priest because it's someone who, like, this might be an unholy thing, or, and he says he'll talk to Russell Crowe. And I noted with interest that he never did.
Uh-huh.
He talks a big game, but he's failing Russell Crowe just like, not just like, but like other priests have. And I feel like at the end, when David Hyde Pierce gets involved and everything like that, I feel like the exorcism isn't just of Russell Crowe's character in a literal and figurative way. I feel like they're also kind of exercising and taking to task the Catholic Church itself. And I think that's... I
wish that read a little better.
I wish it read a little better. I think it's in there, though. I don't think it's not intelligent. I just think it's over. I just think it's heavy-handed and loses its way. This is one of those movies where, overall, I like it. I think it is, overall, it's an interesting premise. It's clearly personal. And I think it yields some really good performances. It is also a bit of a mess.
Hmm.
But it's one of those situations where I'd rather an interesting mess than a boring success. And I think I like this interesting mess overall. I do think it is worth it to look at this from the actor's perspective and to just get involved in Russell Crowe's performance.
It really carries the movie a long way. And I think the directing is pretty sharp. I just think the script is not great.
Yeah.
And I think, and I do think when they decided this needs to be like, the horror was already there. It was emotional horror. Mm-hmm. It was religious horror. I feel like when they decided to make it into a little bit more of like a monster thriller,
a little more literal,
it lost my interest.
It probably would have been better keeping it enigmatic, but well, they made their choices.
And at the end of it is kind of an interesting premise.
Yeah.
The examining the accursed production, they're going to remake it, and now the remake is also a little bit cursed. Sort of like the Inland Empire
thing. I got that vibe from it as well. Joshua John Miller and his partner M.A. Fortin, they co-wrote another meta horror movie called The Final Girls, which I really like. Which is
I didn't realize he wrote that too.
It's starring it's kind of similar actually, because Thaisa Farmiga plays a girl whose mother, played by Malin Ackerman, died, and her one claim to fame was she was like a rising actor, and she had started one hit slasher movie. And so this now hits, this hit slasher movies become kind of like a midnight movie favorite. And she is, she's been kind of avoiding it because it brings up so many traumatic memories, but she is convinced to go to a midnight movie of her mother's film. And then there's a fire in the theater, and the only way to escape is through the screen, and they end up in the movie.
Enter the movie. Yeah,
and now
yeah.
she is living inside this slasher movie with not her mother, but a character her mother plays. And it's actually kind of, it's very silly. There's a lot of like good like meta jokes in it. Like there's a bit where like they realize very quickly what's going on because like there's a scene in the movie playing out where like some guy is driving to a summer camp. And he's like, hey, you going to that summer camp too? I'll pick you up in my truck. And they're like, nope, this is the first scene in the slasher movie. We're all going to die. We're just going to stay here. We're going to let him go. And we're just going to wait for the next car. And then the movie is like 93 minutes long. They wait 93 minutes and then the car comes back.
By again. It's just a loop.
It's really, really clever and funny. It is not nearly as like tormented as this film is, but they make a good double feature, I think.
All right,
moving on. I did not see the new Yorgos Lanthimos film.
Oh, wow.
I obviously wanted to. Life didn't find a way, to paraphrase Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park. Tell me about Kinds of Kindness.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Kinds of Kindness. This is Yorgos Lanthimos doing his shtick again.
Yorgy.
I've now seen enough Yorgos Lanthimos films, and I hate to say this about such a striking, unique director.
He's got a shtick.
To know his shtick.
That's how I felt about Poor Things.
It's just that I feel like he's kind of doing his shtick.
Yeah. He did the dance again. Like it's like it's fine. Mm. It's still more interesting than a lot of other filmmakers out there. But I'm just kind of picking up on it. I can kind of see what he's going to do next.
His themes are about how people require control, and the kinds of control we choose for ourselves are absurd. They're arbitrary. That was very prevalent in Dogtooth, which he made back in, I think it was 2009 that movie came out, which was about some children who were just becoming adults. They were like in their early 20s and they had never left their house. And their father, for some unexplained reason, had been raising them in this sort of sociological experiment where he was redefining language and the way the world worked. He was telling them lies.
Yeah.
And assuring that they never saw the outside world because he was doing something and sociological to them.
So, like, their entire core sense of self is built on a manipulation. Like
everything he told them.
Yeah.
That's something about The Lobster. The Lobster takes place in a world where you must be romantically paired off with someone by law.
Yeah.
Or you will be magically transformed into an animal. You have to go into this black room and you just turn into an animal when you're in there.
Yeah.
There's no special effects. Just
it, come it out happens off screen. Yeah.
And the way romance works in that movie is all totally artificial things. Like a relationship is based on, oh, we both get bloody noses every once in a while.
Right.
We're both left-handed, that kind of thing.
Well, because there's a ticking clock. You have like 30 days if you break up with someone to find someone else or you get turned into an animal. So you have to pair up.
Yeah.
And you'll find any excuse because you don't want to be turned into an animal. I'm not a huge fan of that movie. I don't think they did. It feels like a Monty Python premise that got out of hand.
That's what I like about it.
But I don't think it's funny. I think it's I think it's just it's a huge downer and it stays a huge downer and then it's a huge downer at the end. I just find the modulation off. I don't find it very interesting.
Kinds of Kindness is a triptych. It's three stories where he gets to do his shtick each time. the first short is called The Death of RMF. And all three of these shorts star the same cast.
The Royal Mare Force?
It's one of the characters. It's, it's like a side character that we spend barely any time with, is RMF.
I'm bad with acronyms. I always think it's something else.
No.
All right.
It's not like Royal...
The Royal Mare Force.
Royal Mounted...
Force.
Felice.
Yeah.
Jesse Plemons and... Willem Dafoe and Emma Stone are sort of the key players in all three of the shorts.
Okay.
There's also recurring roles for Mahmouda Atiye, who I really like. Hong Chau is in a couple of them in smaller roles.
Great actor.
And Hunter Schafer has a cameo in one of them.
Cool.
But in the first one, Jesse Plemons plays sort of a well-suited employee of Willem Dafoe. And Willem Dafoe, we learn through sort of a lot of these inferences, has been dictating everything about this guy's life. You know, the kind of the way he worked, how he decorates his house, where he bought his house. We learn later on that he sort of orchestrated the courtship that he went through with his wife, who's played by Hong Chau. And even down to the point where, like, the kind of tea he drinks in the morning and how many chapters he needs to read in a certain book every night. And if he doesn't do these things, it's a huge embarrassment. He's failed his boss.
And, so it's like so it's an employment thing.
It's like he's.
I thought it was like a life coach kind of thing.
No, and we never really learn what sort of how they came to this arrangement, why he agreed to enter into this covenant of control with the Willem Dafoe character, but. When he's a little unhappy with it, and when he finally... we learn what happens when he tries to defy Willem Dafoe.
Okay.
Oh, and excuse me, I forgot to mention, Margaret Qualley is also in all of these shorts.
Yeah. Oh, Margaret Qualley was also in Inside Out, too. They played Anxiety.
Oh, that was Margaret Qualley?
I think it was Margaret Qualley. Am I completely off base? I think it was Margaret Qualley. I'll look that up and tell you if I'm wrong.
Got a little double feature then. And yeah, so that it's the sort of business view of the Yorgos Lanthimos world of control. How this idea that people are very, very willing to give over their will to another person, even if what they're asked to do makes no sense. And of course, that one will...
Maya Hawk, the other Margaret Qualley. I get them confused all the time.
They're both Nepo babies about the same age.
Yeah, and... well, they get the similar parts. Like it's like, and I think they're both talented. I'm actually not complaining. Yeah,
I really like Margaret Qualley.
And they both have names that begin with an M. Cut me some slack.
Okay. Fair.
All right. I was wrong. I admit it. All right. Stop writing the email. We got it.
But yeah, we get to see sort of the how much stress it is for the Jesse Plemons character when he tries to defy the Willem Dafoe character, and also the extremity of the demands, because, like I said, it's going to eventually involve violence and harm.
That kind of kindness. Okay.
The second short is called RMF is Flying.
Okay.
And in this one, Jesse Plemons is married to Emma Stone, who has gone missing on a deserted island.
Okay, so the same actors, different characters.
Different characters.
Okay, got it. I thought it was different adventures of the same character. No.
Each same cast, new characters each
time. Got it.
Margaret Qualley and Mahmoudou Atiye come over for dinner to sort of comfort him while his wife is missing. His wife comes back. They find her. She's rescued.
Great.
Something's amiss.
Oh, no.
She's a little odd. She used to hate meat, and now she likes it. She's behaving in a really aggressively sexual fashion. And in a truly Yorgos Lanthimos twist, we learn that...
Are you going to tell it's a twist?
Well, I'm not going to... Not the twist ending, just sort of a flourish, I should say. Not a twist.
Okay.
Is the Jesse Plemons and Emma Stone characters are actually, like, swingers who swap couples with the Mahmoudou Atiye Margaret Qualley couple. But that's played for laughs. Like, let's watch one of our old videos, and it's like a porno video they made.
Good times.
And we're not really sure if there's something wrong with the Emma Stone character, but pretty soon we learn that there's definitely something wrong with the Jesse Plemons character.
Okay,
gone a little bit weird.
Okay.
And then there's a twist.
Yes.
And then there's a third short called RMF Eats a Sandwich. And this one is just straight up cult. Willem Dafoe runs a sex cult, and they're looking for some kind of messianic figure, and they've sent Emma Stone and Jesse Plemons out in the world to find this messiah figure who might have magical powers of some kind, and they have to meet a very strict set of circumstances, and they carry their own water from a magical spring, that kind of stuff. As you can see, this is all Yorgos Lanthimos kind of brainstorming. What would be a good idea for a movie? Mm-hmm. None of these could carry a feature on their own, so he decided to make three-quarters features.
Okay.
And it's long. Oh. It goes way to, this is like a three-hour film.
Oh, my God.
Like, each short is about an hour long.
All right.
If they had a Kinds of Kindness miniseries...
Yeah.
Just like
maybe
have
just
a couple,
make some short films.
Or make a... just reduce these to a short...
Wes Anderson got his Oscar. Why don't you just make some short films?
You just give them to Netflix. I'm sure they'd be happy to have them. So it is just, while each one is really skilled and we get to sort of lose ourselves in that Lanthimosian labyrinth that we're kind of familiar with now, it is just sort of the same point repeated three times. Mm. These shorts don't really interplay off of each other in any kind of significant way. It is nice to see great actors doing great work. I think Jesse Plemons is an excellent actor.
Great actor.
Willem Dafoe is one of the greatest actors.
Yeah. Emma Stone is no slouch.
And Emma Stone, I think...
Really talented.
Was really wise to pair off with Yorgos Lanthimos because he's getting great performances out of her. I've seen her give some pretty mediocre performances in other movies. And she's working with an interesting director, she's giving interesting performances.
Yeah, no, she's capable of amazing things. Yeah. She just doesn't always get amazing roles. But yeah, no, I agree. Bummer.
So I gave it a very positive review when I wrote about it, and I've kind of cooled on it since I wrote the review.
Yeah, the high wore off.
A little bit. I'm a little less impressed with what happened now that I'm kind of understanding that everything I saw in it was right there on the surface.
Yeah.
There's not, like, something complicated to discuss about this movie.
Mm-hmm.
If you're already familiar with Yorgos Lanthimos.
Sure,
if
this is your first one, this might blow your mind.
Yeah. And maybe if you came in with Poor Things, because that was kind of his big hit, I guess. Like, The Favorite was also an Oscar darling.
Mm-hmm.
I do like when people like Yorgos Lanthimos break into the awards circuit. It's like, remember when David Lynch did the same thing?
Now it's okay to, like, give these kinds of movies awards, but only when Yorgos does it.
Well, like, there are certain artists who can sort of...
Yeah.
Crack the code.
Yeah,
and be weird and quirky unto themselves and somehow get awards attention.
Yeah. There's something I was thinking about, and again, I haven't seen this one, so I can't speak to it, but based on what you're talking about, of how I feel like it kind of fits into his oeuvre, but it's not the best film. I feel like something happens, and, you know, I kind of played into it, where there's a particular filmmaker and they have a particular style or a particular vision or particular themes that they would come back to over and over again, and then... We kind of get used to them. That doesn't mean they're necessarily making bad films about it. And I feel like that's happened with, like, people like Terrence Malick, where, you know, you do a Tree of Life and then you follow it up with a To the Wonder, which is very, very similar.
Yeah.
And people kind of wrote it off. And it's like, no, it's also great.
It's also great. Yeah, To the Wonder is excellent.
I'll grant you it's a little repetitive, but not everyone's going to see these movies back to back the way you did. Over time, people might discover To the Wonder first.
Yeah.
And they're going to have a very different experience of it than people who are, you know, staying their fingers on the pulse. So, I don't know. Maybe this is one of those things where we're familiar enough that it's we're not giving it its fair due. I don't know. It's a thought.
That's an interesting thought. And if one of the shorts had been expanded into a feature, maybe that would be the phenomenon that I'm looking at. But now we've had, you know, Poor Things, and we're chasing it with three more that are really similar.
Fair enough.
He just sort of crammed three movies into one.
Yeah.
And now we kind of understand, he has a shtick.
Fair enough.
And I'm not saying it's wearing thin, but I feel like he has done more impressive things in other movies.
That's fair. All right. Do you want to take the other movie you watched, or do you want me to talk about Exuma?
Tell me about Exuma.
Exuma. Exuma. Not like the skin condition, it's
eczema. Yeah.
It's E-X-H-U-M-A. It is a new Korean horror movie. It is debuted on Shudder, and it is really good. Anyway, tell me about your next... No, I'm kidding.
Well done. Okay.
Yeah, okay. Exuma is a horror film about a group of people who... They're not exorcists. Like, the American version of this would probably be more about exorcism. But they solve supernatural problems. And they approach it with the methodical nature of like a Michael Mann cast.
All right.
Like it's like if Heat, but we deal with ghosts, like kind of thing. It's a great vibe. At the beginning of the movie, these two characters are approached by a very rich man. He feels haunted. Like every time he closes his eyes, he feels like he's being choked. And he just they just had a baby, and it's newborn, brand new person. And it won't stop crying unless it's sedated. It's clearly going through some kind of hell, and it's a medical mystery, and they don't know why. So they investigate, and they discover that this has something to do with an ancestor from beyond the grave who is tormenting them.
Okay.
So what they do is they enlist a funeral director and a guy who is... what's the word? It's like feng shui, but for nature. Like, he just reads the environment and finds where the supernatural places are. And they find the grave of the guy's grandfather.
Okay.
And it turns out that there is a thing that sometimes happens with ancestors where if something is off, something is amiss, something to do with the family, or something was taken from their grave, they're basically spinning in their grave. And that is affecting their bloodline.
They're literally turning in their grave.
Yeah, basically they're literally turning in their grave, and it is affecting the lives of the people in their bloodline. So that grave needs to be dug up, it needs to be sanctified, and the body either needs to be moved or cremated. And this is something they have to do a lot, apparently. They have a whole system. But this one's a little different, because this one, for some reason... The grandfather was buried at the top of a mountain in a very, very weird place, in a very, very weird way.
Was it a pet cemetery?
No, it's not a pet cemetery, right. But like when it's cool. It's cool. I'm gonna let you discover it for yourself. But basically, what should be a pretty standard procedure goes hinky real fast.
Okay.
And just when I think, excuse me, I know what this movie is, it concludes something and then goes into another direction. It's very, very cool. Like, sorry, you think it's going to be about this family tormented by this evil grandfather, and it is. But that's just the first layer of the mystery, and it turns out there's actually more underneath that.
Okay.
And now the movie's about that, too. And it's very, very well, like, laid out. It's like, it's got, like, five chapters, and each chapter just adds new material to... A pretty interesting piece, and it's genuinely quite scary. There's some really, really good supernatural horror bits. But the thing that I really glommed onto more than anything else is just this cast of characters who are just good at their jobs. I've talked about this a lot. I never really successfully tracked down this quote. I know I've read it somewhere. I think it was Hitchcock who said that if you want to get people to like a character, all you have to do is show that they're good at their job.
Yeah,
we respect people who are good at their job.
I've said before, like that it's an exhilarating drama when somebody just does something well.
Yeah, exactly. We just are impressed and we respect them for it. And here is when you have, and Michael Mann specializes in this. Almost everyone in his movies is like a crackerjack professional. And here we have a bunch of crackerjack professionals who they have different personalities. They're interesting people, but they're supernatural investigators. And this isn't like a super cool Constantine kind of universe. Mm. And this isn't like kind of a wacky Ghostbusters universe. This is just a steely and intense dramatic universe.
Hmm.
And yet, as the supernatural mystery progresses, we move from kind of one idea of a horror movie to a much, maybe a broader idea of a horror movie in ways that feel pretty organic. The imagery shifts from one kind of horror movie to another. I have to be vague because I want you to discover it for yourself.
Yeah,
I'm just genuinely impressed by this movie. It is wonderfully stylish. Got a great cast of characters. It's very well written. It creates an interesting universe full of rules that makes sense. There comes to be an element towards the end, and I'm trying to think about how to describe this without ruining anything. I can see a moment towards the end where they're talking about ghosts from a certain region.
Okay.
And it comes across a little A little fucking judgy.
It's only a poltergeist if it comes from the poltergeist region of France.
Well, no, it's like, oh, no. If it's,
otherwise,
if
it's just if it's a spookling white ghost.
Like, ghosts from this country will just kill you for no reason. I hate those ghosts. It's a little like... I know that there's, like, a long, complicated history of, like, different relationships between different countries and cultures.
Yeah.
It's a little off-putting.
I was shocked. I've traveled to Finland in the past.
Excuse me. Oh, I had a cold earlier this week, and it just won't go away. Sorry about that. I mean, I'm well. It's just the throat got carved up.
Well, yeah. If I get sick, I'll know what to blame.
That's fair.
No, I traveled to Finland when I was a teenager, and I was shocked to learn that they have a lot of Norway jokes in Finland. It's like, Finland and Norway, what do you guys have against each other? Well, they're neighbors.
Yeah. That's all. Yeah. They're, I'm sure Canada has a ton of jokes about America.
Yeah.
And we deserve all of them. It's fine.
No, be harsher. We deserve more.
No, seriously. Keep it coming. Keep it coming. We keep giving you material, don't we? Dear God. Okay. Anyway. But no, Exuma, it's really, really good. It's definitely, like, smartly crafted, really suspenseful. And yeah, it has a lot to say about sort of national character, I think, at the end, in a way that I'm probably not equipped to dissect well enough, just because I'm not involved in Korean culture enough to understand the nuances. So I may be coming at it from a distance there and looking at it purely like in terms of narrative plot and character. But even on that level, it's exciting filmmaking. So yeah. I highly recommend checking out Exuma. It is currently exclusively on Shudder, and it is well worth checking out.
Nice.
All right, and lastly, Slave Play, not a movie, a play.
Slave Play, I was just looking up the play itself, is a play that was written by Jeremy O. Harris. It's opened on Broadway, I think, last year, and it became the most nominated play in Tony history at the time.
Wow.
Okay. It has since been outstripped by the one that was nominated this year.
Okay.
Let's see. Yeah, I was nominated for, I think, 12 Tonys, and it won none of them.
That's impressive.
So, yeah.
You were the American Hustle of your time.
The play starts in on a antebellum southern plantation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a series of vignettes about how... about a relationship between one white character and one black character.
Mm.
The black character is typically a slave in these antebellum scenes.
That does make a certain amount of sense.
And how there is a lot of sexual manipulation going on at the hands of the white character, trying to manipulate the slaves that they own.
Mm-hmm.
And then, in a bit of a twist, at the end of each one of these scenes, the character will say, you know what, I can't do this anymore. I'm not into this. Do we have to keep doing this? And the lights come up, and it turns out that this is modern day, and this has all been a role-playing scenario where they're working out their sexual frustrations through a slave scenario.
Oh, my God.
It's like this weird kind of couples counseling for interracial couples.
Oh, and the that's whole and the second, so hence, Neil LaBute.
Slave Play, get it?
Oh, my God. Yeah. Okay, great. All right. Is this like, just a filmed version of the play, or is it, like,
no,
a documentary?
No, in fact, this is a documentary.
Okay.
Not just about the writing of the play and what the play is about, but it takes us behind the scenes, and there's actually a lot of discussion as to the various actors who play each individual role.
Okay.
Like, you know, all of the understudies, they all get to sort of audition their piece, how they're working through their discomfort with the material, what the play. Right, and the playwright and director of the play is actually very bright and very upbeat about this. Like, I understand this is a really weird, but why don't you do something a little fucked up? So here's, like, you know, we're dealing with sexual dynamics between these characters.
Yeah.
There's one queer couple. Most of them are, but they're all interracial couples, and they're kind of like, he's examining
all going through similar role-play dynamic.
What does it mean to be in an interracial couple? Can we explore that through these really terrifying images of slavery in antebellum South?
Okay.
It's kind of strange how bright and brisk the film version is. They're way wise to say Slave Play, not a movie, a play.
Yeah.
Because, and there's even periods in the title. Please put more punctuation in your film titles. It's okay. You can put question marks and commas. It's, and
I long for a semicolon.
Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Question mark. It's okay.
It is in there. That's official.
It's not on the title screen.
No.
They took it out.
They took it out. It did used to be there, right? I'm not insane.
You look up like early press materials and the question mark is still there. And then they took it out at some point.
Now it sounds like the conclusion of a sentence, you know. This guy, comma, who killed Roger Rabbit.
Yeah, it's an independent clause.
That's the word I'm looking for. Thank you.
The one that cracks me up is...
God, we're nerds.
Absolutely. We're writers. We pay attention to that kind of thing.
I know.
I hate that Lara Croft Tomb Raider has no punctuation in it.
Yeah.
Lara Croft Tomb Raider. That's her name. Lara Raider.
Oh, yeah.
Croft Tomb is her middle name.
No, drives you up the wall as well. Yeah.
That's drives me nuts. But this has three periods in the title.
Okay.
Slave play, period, not a movie play, period, a play, period.
Got it.
I feel like when you're dealing with like kind of this provocative material, that you do have to keep it light backstage. You can't just be...
Oh, God, can you imagine how oppressive it would be?
And you know, these are all Broadway actors. They're all taking their parts very seriously, but they're actors. They're worried about sort of reading the lines and getting the emotions. And, you know, when they're done with their scene, they'll kind of, you know, they'll say scene, and then they'll do that sort of very wonderfully theatrical thing where they'll all sit in a circle cross-legged and kind of rap, you know, and here's a few notes, and what do you think this is about? And we'll do some, like, improv exercises.
Yeah.
And it all becomes very warm, and you get a...
Yeah,
that sort of theatrical sense of family that you get when you work on a play. I'm not sure if you've ever done any acting or if you've ever been involved in theater.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
You didn't know that?
No, I didn't think you did. I know you wrote like screenplays. You went to film school.
Yeah, no, I did a lot of theater in high school and college.
Oh, okay.
Like a lot. Like I was in How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying.
Oh, that's right. You told me that.
Yeah. No, I did a lot.
It's more about the experience of making the play and kind of explaining it. He kind of talks to other people about, like, press agents, like, what the play is about, but then that's not what the movie's about. It's more about, and, you know, there's a lot of very revealing moments where he sort of, like, somebody's going to sit down, the filmmakers are going to sit down next to him and just say, what do you think this documentary is about? What are we doing here?
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of self-reflection going on.
Symbiopsychotaxiplasm.
That kind of thing, yeah. We're kind of commenting on the media. That is also commenting on the media, and that even comes to a head at the end where they're editing it, and they show footage of them editing it, and then that footage of them editing that footage.
And that snake is going like, this tail is delicious.
Yeah, but it's not being done in sort of like a cutesy way. It's actually, he's clearly kind of doing it because he's trying to connect what he was going through, like, what he was thinking when he was writing this play. Like, what was his creative process? And he talks a lot about his inspirations and his creative process.
What I'm not getting from you yet, and I think this is what I'm kind of getting at, you're talking about what they're getting at and what, you know, the movie's trying to accomplish. I can't tell if the movie is good or not.
It is fascinating.
Okay.
Especially if you're interested in theater. Not necessarily this play. If you are into this play, it... Because, you know, we're not just doing a filmed version of the play.
Right.
Nor are we doing a making of the play. We're doing kind of like a meditation on what it was to make this play. There's not a narrative. You know, here's opening night. Here's the steps we're going to go through. It's more like the brainstorming process, which for me, I think, is a lot more exciting than just a pretty broad, basic, step-by-step chronological presentation of what they went through on the way to opening night.
That sounds like the making of the play.
That's boring. That's the making of the play. I don't want to hear that.
That's not what it is.
No, that's not what it is.
I don't know.
It's much more about figuring out what thoughts are in your head, and you're kind of just brainstorming and analyzing what the play is about, what the playwright is all about, what the actors are all about, and how, even though they're dealing with kind of fucked up material, it's very lax. Everybody's very relaxed. Everybody's in a great mood. Nobody has, you know, bad blood with anybody else. It's really interesting to see different actors play the same parts, because there are all these understudies. We get to see them each sort of deliver the same dialogue, and I like seeing just different approaches to acting. And it just sort of gets the theater gland going a little bit. If you were a theater kid, because I too was a theater kid, I actually majored in theater in college. you're going to be salivating a little bit.
Okay.
Because when you're bitten by the theater bug, it never goes away. Not entirely.
No. It's mandible sticking even if you try to remove it.
Yeah. I haven't been in a play since I was a teenager. But it would be nice.
Do you still have that dream where, like, you got to go on stage and you forgot your lines?
Yeah, I do.
I still have that. It's usually like, oh, hey, listen, you know that play you were in when you were in high school? Well, there's a production of it right now, and the guy who played J.B. Bigley in How to Succeed in Business didn't make it. You remember your lines, right? And you're like, and they push you out on stage. I'm like, oh, shit. I hope I remember this.
Going to have to improvise a little bit.
Yeah. But, oh, God. That and the, I didn't study, like, there's a class I had, I forgot I was taking in college, and now the final is tomorrow. Why do those never go away? They dissipate. You don't get as many, but they'll pop up.
They come up every once in a while, and you feel that same stress.
Oh, my God. Never go away.
I have the same thing, the college dream, but it's my college, the one I attended in Washington State, but it's a completely different campus, but it's the same different campus every time in my dream.
Yeah, you created
it's the same weird alien composite version of the campus, like, recurs in my dream of my college. Yeah. It doesn't look anything like my college, though.
Yeah, I hear you. I have the same, like, there's the dream version of my parents' house.
Yeah.
It's like definitely my parents' house, and there's elements of it that are the same, but it's not. That hallway isn't there. There's a secret compartment in the room, that kind of thing.
You love that film Ritual, with Emily Mortimer about the ill mother that she and her sister have to move back, or no, her and her daughter have to move back in and take care of her.
I still haven't
seen
that one, actually.
Anyway, we're far afield from
Slave Play.
If you're paying attention to the Tonys, then you're going to be interested in seeing this. But I think this is going to be a better portrait of something like Slave Play than just watching a film's production of it.
Okay.
Because we actually get to sort of delve a little bit. It's having the conversation while we discover the play. And I like that. I like that approach.
All right.
And it's very brief. It's like 72 minutes.
Oh, well, sold.
Yeah.
72 minutes. Ah, I'm there. All right, moving on.
I was able to watch a movie, come home, and just watch this one, because it was so short. I don't know. It's not,
what a treat.
It's not like Horizon Part 1, which I think is 3 hours and 20 minutes
or
something.
It's over three. I saw it already. Yeah, it's over three. Yeah, it's, well, we'll talk about that next week, actually.
All right.
But let's do our review roundup. We review movies on a scale of C- to C+. A C- is a movie we don't recommend that is below average. A C is a movie that is just okay. You know, mixed bag. And a C+ is a movie we do recommend. That is an above-average movie. We might think it's just really fun. We might think it's brilliant. But it's above average, that's for damn sure. Slave Play, not a movie, a play. Whitney, go.
It's a very high C.
Okay.
It's not transcendent, but I appreciate its brainstormy, analytical approach as opposed to something a little bit more literal.
Yeah, okay. Exuma, I'm going to give it a C+. It is not... I don't think it's an instant horror classic or anything, but it does exactly what it's doing really well.
Okay.
I think it is, it's just a slick, professional, scary, imaginative production, and I would recommend it to pretty much anyone who likes horror movies.
So, excellent. I'm sorry, I missed it. It's on Shudder, right?
It's on Shudder. It is not 72 minutes. It's 2 hours, but worth it.
Okay.
Totally worth it. We're overselling that. What was it Ebert said? No good movie is too long, and no bad movie is short enough. Yeah, exactly. Kinds of Kindness.
Kinds of Kindness. Is this C?
Okay.
It's interesting and a little bit twisted, but it's a twisted I know. And that's less twisted, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I enjoy the messages we're getting, and I love the actors. I like the cast, but it's like we're spinning wheels a little bit with this one.
Fair enough. The Exorcism.
It's a low C.
Okay.
It's not a wash. I think the second half is, but that first half is really strong, and Russell Crowe lifts it way higher than it ever deserved to be, because he's such a good actor.
I'm going to give it a high C. I liked it more than you.
Okay.
I don't think it ever... It's too sloppy to achieve, I think, true greatness. But I agree that Russell Crowe is the anchor here, and I think that the second half, although it does definitely overplay its hand, I do think it's getting at some more interesting things than you're giving it credit for.
All right.
But overall, it's an interesting piece, and I'm happy to reward that. Or rather, I appreciate that.
Okay.
There's no... I don't think anyone's grateful for a fucking C. But like, but like, no, I'm happy. I appreciate that, and I think uh-huh. that makes it, you know, if that sort of thing interests you, it's worth checking out. But it's not amazing. Hmm. And then lastly, Inside Out 2.
Inside Out 2. It's a C+. You know what? I think it did it very strongly. I'm only reluctant to give it a high grade because of the Pixar press release.
Yeah.
But in terms...
You have to deal with the actual movie.
But I'm dealing with the movie itself. You know, don't... Outside of that context, I think it does have... does tell a good story. I like Riley as a character. I like visiting her emotional world. And... still got me. Still crying in the movie. Yeah. So, and also its definition and depiction of anxiety as an emotional force in your life, I think was actually very wise.
I think it was useful. I think that depiction. I think that's something that when it comes right down to it, I think as I was leaving the theater, I was thinking to myself, did Pixar just make me feel bad for my anxiety? Because my anxiety has been trying to murder me for as long as I can remember. Like, it's a really, really oppressive force. And since I saw that movie, I've been thinking about my anxiety. And I kind of knew it already. Uh-huh. But, like, they phrased it in such a clear way that I'm like, you know what? You know, maybe my mind doesn't mean to be out to get me. And that's kind of a nice thought.
Or, you know, if you're visualizing it in a Pixar way, you have anxiety, this little orange being living in your brain. But in your case, it has a gun.
Yeah, basically. But no, it's a C+. I think it's a really, really good movie.
And your other emotions have to wrestle it to the ground occasionally.
Yeah, more or less. All right, so that is it for Critically Acclaimed this week. We'll be back next week with reviews of Hey, Horizon, an American Saga, the first... and a planned 4-part giant epic film from Kevin Costner. Also,
you know what? Don't aim low.
Right?
Why the hell not? Make it big.
Go for it. Also, A Quiet Place Day One. Also, Janet Planet. Also, Daddy-O and A Family Affair. And maybe something else. I don't know. That's a
Daddy-O?
Lot of movies. Yeah.
Dick Contino?
No, it's a drama that reunites Sean Penn and Dakota Fanning.
Oh,
they're in I Am Sam. It's an unrelated production. It's just
I Am Sam is a miserable film.
It's not a good film. it's sort of. I mean, Dakota Fanning, I think, is on a reunion tour. They also did The Equalizer 3 to work with Denzel again.
Yeah.
So yeah. Anyway, that's coming up next. Thank you everybody for listening. Thank you for joining us. Huge shout out to all of our patrons over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. You mean the world to us. We're incredibly grateful to you. We couldn't do the show without your support. If you want to join our Patreon, you can vote for future episodes of some of our shows. You can listen to all of our new episodes ad-free, and you get access to a lot of exclusive shows, including our show where we review every single episode of Star Trek in order.
Mm-hmm.
Hundreds of episodes are just unlocked immediately when you sign up for that. We got commentary tracks. We just did a commentary track for AVP, Alien vs. Predator. Why? We suddenly felt the urge to.
We literally decided it that night.
Yeah.
The night we were recording.
When it was like, hey, you want to do a commentary track for Alien vs. Predator? And I was like, kinda. So we did. And that's the kind of wonders you'll get on the Critically Acclaimed Patreon. So please subscribe if you haven't already and head on over to Patreon for a lot of cool stuff. And of course, if you want to talk about anything we discussed in this episode, we love hearing from you. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, what is our P.O. Box?
Yeah, send us a physical letter to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yeah, you might read your email on an upcoming episode of We've Got Mail. You may have noticed that Thank Godzilla It's Friday has wrapped up. Thank you to everyone for your support of that show. If you missed it, we will be returning after a couple of weeks off with a new rebooted version of Canceled Too Soon.
Coming back.
It's the show that kind of launched this particular wave of our podcast. We review TV shows that lasted only one season or less. This isn't going to be back for a whole year. We're going to do it for a couple of months and maybe bring it back again periodically afterwards. But we want to get to some of the shows that everyone always asks us to do. So it's going to be a cool crop. And after that, we're going to do a show in which we're going to try to review every single movie ever directed by Roger Corman.
That's right.
Rest in peace, Raj. So anyway, thank you very much. We're on social media. I'm at William Bibbiani.
At Lenny Seibel.
And never forget, everyone is a critic.
I wanna go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.